Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa aparita te sangamata sadvara yeso tapanto pamanchantu sada. Okay, so been invited to come and give the talk for this evening after discussions with Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Wayama, and especially to talk about the topic of bhikkhunis. And some of you may know what bhikkhunis are, some may not, but anyway, bhikkhunis are fully ordained Buddhist nuns. There's a bit of an article in the foyer here. Ajahn Brahm did an interview a couple of weeks ago with a Bangkok newspaper, so there's some basic information there. And the topic is a very interesting one, and one which opens up a lot of avenues and issues which are very relevant in how we understand our Buddhist tradition, both in terms of the origins of our tradition, how it's developed over the past, how it's evolved in different places, and also especially, of course, in terms of how we are to apply and practice Buddhism and the Dhamma in the best possible way in our Australian culture. Of course, in our environment, where we are practicing Buddhism, of course, is very different from, you know, traditional Buddhist cultures and from the kinds of Buddhism which have evolved over the last 2,500 years. So we face many new issues, new challenges, and we have to sort of reinvestigate, reorientate ourselves on our Buddhist, with our Buddhist heritage, to be able to understand this and to proceed in the best way. Now, I'm sure many of you, of course, are familiar with the Dhammasara Nuns Monastery with Ajahn Wayama there. And you're familiar with having the nuns come in their brown robes and so on. And you're probably wondering what's the issue or what's the problem. And we already have the Buddhist nuns. But when I said bhikkhuni, I said fully ordained Buddhist nuns. Yeah. And so the nuns at Dhammasara have taken the 10 precepts, which are like the 10 precepts that the novices take. And so they're not considered among the ordained Sangha, they're not considered as fully ordained. Okay, so they're ordained, but perhaps not fully ordained, right? And so this is that kind of bit of an issue. And again, it's one of those things which is, on the surface of it, perhaps just a detail. You might just dismiss it. It's just it's not really important to the heart of practice. And in a sense, that's quite correct, that these are matters of convention. They're not matters of really the ultimate truth. But still, how we handle conventions is a very important part of our lives. We can't just dismiss conventions because they're conventions. Actually, conventions are extremely important. So what I want to talk a bit about this evening is what it means to be fully ordained, why we think this is important, why the nuns at Dhammasara, Ajahn Wayama and so on, are interested in moving towards having bhikkhuni ordination, and what we see the benefit or what the point of that is. So a little bit of my background, like staying, as Dennis mentioned earlier, at Santi Forest Monastery outside Sydney, and it's always been my intention, and even before I arrived there actually, to provide facilities for both monks, nuns, laymen and lay women. And this, of course, is the what we call in Buddhism the fourfold assembly. So I don't know how many are familiar with this idea, but when the Buddha talked about his religion and his community, he always talked about it as the fourfold assembly. It's bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and lay women. And so this is a very kind of balanced picture of a community. And when the Buddha talked about this, even from the very night of his enlightenment, from the very time he was enlightened, he said he would not pass away into parinibbana before he had established this fourfold assembly, because bhikkhunis, laymen and lay women. So this was his mission statement, right? He said, this is my mission statement, this is my vision, this is what I want to do. Yeah, and so to me, that's a very nicely balanced sort of setup, very, very, very symmetrical, and it's not merely it's this is not merely like a contingent or kind of socially dependent structure, but it actually, I think, goes much deeper. It actually speaks to something quite deep about the human condition. Yeah, that each of these four assemblies actually represents a part of us in a way. Like the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis represent the spiritual side of life. The laymen, laywomen represent the worldly, the engaged part of life. And so each of us actually have this part within us. So, you know, in conventional sense, we think we either belong to one group or the other, yeah? But in reality, yeah, not in convention, but in the reality of our own minds, we're actually, we orientate ourselves among these groups, yeah? We have a sense of identity which connects with these groups. And as long as these groups are not there and are not fully present, then our sense of identity is somehow fractured. And I think this has become the case in some of the forms of Buddhism which we've inherited from medieval times, where the bhikkhuni sangha has lapsed. For one, I'll talk a little bit more about the history in a minute, but the forms which we inherit from Thailand, from Sri Lanka, Burma, in those countries, the bhikkhuni sangha has lapsed over the years, and so we only have the male sangha as the monks, which represent the spiritual community. And I think that's a shame. I think that's a loss. That's a diminishing of the vision which the Buddha had for his assembly, for his followers. So at our monastery, we're trying to re-establish the fourfold assembly and establish the bhikkhuni community and so on, and that's an ongoing process, and is part of a much broader process within Buddhism as a whole and within Buddhism all around the world. Just recently, just on my way here actually, from Santi Monastery, I should mention on last weekend, on Sunday, we performed our Samaneri ordination, so a novice ordination for one of the women there. So that's a very beautiful occasion in our meditation, our famous meditation cave. So if you're interested, have a look on the web and you'll find some pictures of that. And so to me, this is a very important kind of moment that we're starting to bring Buddhism into an Australian environment. Literally, right? We're in a cave, right? We're actually inside Australia, yeah, to do that. After that, I went to Canberra. And as part of a Buddhist delegation, we went to the Parliament House in Canberra, and we had a meeting arranged with the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Was his name Harry someone, I think? Anyone who's the name of the Speaker? I can't remember. Anyway, who was a very nice chap. And we presented him as a Buddhist delegation, myself, Venerable Chigwang Sunim, a Korean bhikkhuni, Lama Chodak Rinpoche, Tibetan teacher, Venerable David Lungdok, Tibetan monk, and representatives of the Buddhist councils around Australia. And we presented the speaker with a copy of the Dhammapada. Okay, so many of you are familiar with the Dhammapada, very central Buddhist text, and one which is very fundamental to Buddhist teachings, yeah, especially in the Theravadan school. But we agreed among ourselves that the teachings found in the Dhammapada are very common. They represent all the teachings of Buddhism. So they're not specific to one school. So we thought this is something we can present as a Buddhist community. So we gave that to the Speaker of the House. And, of course, it has very wonderful verses, like it says, to hatred is never appeased by hatred, but is only appeased by love. This is an eternal law. So I think some of those things would be very useful for the House of Representatives. And so since the Speaker's job is to try to keep everyone calm, he'll probably find it quite useful. So we offered that as part of a Buddhist community to be placed in the dispatches box in the Parliament. Okay, so they currently have the Bible and the Quran in a box there, and so now they'll have the Dhammapada there as well. So it's, I think, very, very significant. We also talked about introducing multi-faith prayers in the Parliament of Australia, so that instead of just reciting the Lord's Prayer, they would recite different prayers from different faith groups on different days. So this, I think, is very symbolically very significant and indicates a maturing of the kind of Australian religious landscape, and represents a kind of literally, again, bringing Buddhism within, you know, the heart of Australian culture, yeah, and the heart of the political establishment or different aspects of Australian culture. So the reason I mention this now is because I think we all need to be aware of the fact that we are, you know, bringing and practicing Buddhism within this environment, yeah? And just as the Australian environment and culture will be influenced by Buddhism, and so too Buddhism will be influenced by our surrounding culture as well. This is how Buddhism has survived and grown for 2,500 years. So part of that movement, of course, part of that movement will be the rehabilitation and the strengthening of the involvement of women within Buddhism. And I think this is so obvious it hardly needs to be stated. We should take it for granted. This has already been happening and will continue to happen. So what I want to talk about is why the Bhikkhuni Sangha is very important in that development. Yeah. So moving towards developing a more balanced community for Buddhism, and one which is going to be more integrated and reflect better our Australian environment. Now, when the Buddha, as I mentioned before, when the Buddha was enlightened, he made this determination that he would not pass away until he had established the what he called the fourfold Sangha, because bhikkhunis, laymen, laywomen. Now, we have recorded in the ancient Buddhist texts the story of how these things came to be established. So we have the story of how the first monks came to be ordained, how the first laymen came to be taught and converted to Buddhism, how the first laywomen came and came to be converted to Buddhism. And we also have a story of the establishment of the Bhikkhuni order by the Buddha's foster mother, Mahapajapati. Now, the interesting thing and the troubling thing from the Buddhist point of view is that if we look at the establishment of the other three assemblies, we don't have any problems. There's no issues. It's perfectly straightforward. People come along, they say they want to practice. The Buddha says, great, that's terrific, come along, practice, and we get on with it, and there's no problems. When it's a Bhikkhuni Sangha, it's very different. And the story of the foundation of the Bhikkhuni order has been a very major point in the reluctance of among some parts of Buddhism, modern Buddhism, to support the reintroduction of the Bhikkhuni order. So according to the traditional accounts, when Mahapajapati, the Buddha's stepmother, comes to see the Buddha, she asks to receive ordination, and he says, ma ruchi, which means something like, don't ask for that, okay? Don't want to have ordination for women, okay? So he doesn't say you can't ordain, but he says don't ask for that. And three times she asks, three times she's refused, she goes away, yeah? Later on, the Buddha leaves that place, Mahapajapati, with the other women from the Sakyan Republic, follow the Buddha. And then they arrive at the monastery where she's dirty and soiled from the journey, and she's waiting outside the gates weeping. Yeah, but you get this very kind of moving image. You know, Mahapajapati, she's an older woman by this stage. Yeah, she's weeping outside of the monastery gates. She can't come in because she's been refused by the Buddha. That's a very touching image. And then Venerable Ananda comes along and says, because of course Mahapajapati was his auntie, and he says, what's the problem? She tells him the story, and then he represents her case to the Buddha. And without going into all the details, eventually the Buddha said, okay, I'll give the ordination, but I lay down eight conditions, which we call the eight Garudhammas. Okay, so eight Garudhammas means like rules of respect. And again, without going into all the details, but the first one of those Garudhammas says that a bhikkhuni who's been ordained, even if she's been ordained for 100 years, she has to bow and worship at the feet of a monk who's been ordained that very day. Okay? So this is the first rule that the Buddha laid down, apparently, at the start of the Bhikkhuni order. Right? Now, strangely enough, most of the monks that I've met have found this to be an eminently plausible story. Yeah? But some of the nuns feel that there may be some question mark over it. So this is obviously that rule, I mean, what's it about? Okay, it's about some kind of, it's an establishment of a relation of respect, okay, between the Bhikkhu Sangha and Bhikkhuni Sangha. And in a sense, obviously, the Bhikkhuni Sangha is placed in a way which is subservient to the Bhikkhu Sangha. And there's obviously this sense that the Buddha was reluctant to ordain. Okay, so this is the impression that you get from this story. Now, personally, I don't believe that story, okay? So, you know, I encourage you to get hold of the traditional accounts and read them and so on. And they certainly they're passed down in the ancient scriptures and it's found quite widely spread among the Buddhist traditions. But I've done a lot of text critical research into this in other areas and like most scholars in modern times, are not convinced of the historicity of this particular story. In fact, I've found mentions and analyses of these stories by about 20 or 30 modern scholars, and all of them dispute the historicity of this story. And I haven't found a single modern scholar, whether monastic or lay, who has really tried to defend the historicity of that particular story. Okay, who has been able to find a solid argument to defend it. So there are, I don't want to go into too much details, but there are some serious question marks over that. Now, tomorrow we're going to be having a Bhikkhuni seminar from 2:00 in the afternoon. So in that seminar we can discuss some more of the details of these things. But for now I just want to do a general introduction. So we have this story, a myth of origins. It tells where the Bhikkhunis came from, and that story is broken, okay? It has fracture lines through it. And those fracture lines lend an emotional charge to this whole issue of bhikkhunis and bhikkhuni ordination, which informs the modern debate in these things, okay? We can't escape that. We can't pretend that doesn't happen. It happens. Nevertheless, despite that kind of ambiguity or ambivalent feeling in that particular story, what's often overlooked is that throughout all of the rest of the Buddhist scriptures, you don't find that ambivalent feeling. Okay, and so there are many, many other of the early scriptures which present the bhikkhunis in a very positive light, which present the Buddha as being very supportive and helpful and encouraging for the bhikkhunis, which preserve the teachings and the very words of the ancient bhikkhunis in their own speech, their own voice, preserved down through the years. And we should reflect on that. That's something quite extraordinary. You know, we're talking 500 BC, yeah? How many women's voices from 500 BC exist anywhere in the world? Yeah? Vanishingly few. And there's vanishingly little spiritual literature from women from anything like that period of antiquity. And yet with the Buddhists we have hundreds of verses which are uttered by the enlightened bhikkhunis at that time. And some of them give some you know, good insight into the psychology of the nuns at that time. Like one of the verses says, starts out, "I'm freed, I'm so happy, I'm freed of the three crooked things, the mortar, the pestle, and my crooked husband." So sometimes the issues which were confronting them in those days weren't so different from the issues that confront us today. So we had this community, and obviously a very strong community, a vibrant community, and lots of examples of enlightened nuns who were giving great teachings. They would teach the kings at that time. They had a very autonomous community. So remember that in ancient India, according to the ancient Indian social customs, like a woman was always supposed to be dependent on the men. Yeah? So when you were young, you're dependent on your father. When you grew up, you were dependent on your husband, and then in your old age, you were dependent on your sons. Yeah, so that wasn't, according to the Hindu law books, a woman should never be independent. Okay, whereas in the Buddhist system, once the bhikkhuni monasteries were established, they had a very, very autonomous existence, and they decided everything. And this is recorded in a lot of detail in the Buddhist Vinaya, the Buddhist monastic codes, how the bhikkhunis would build their own monasteries, yeah, organize for the construction of their buildings and all of these kinds of things. They would do their own teachings and so on and so forth. So when we compare this with the Garudhamma, the rule that the bhikkhunis have to bow down to a bhikkhus, then it's worth asking about how that actually worked out in context. Was this something that they actually did, or was it just a rule that the monks wanted them to do? Or in some ways, you know, it's quite interesting that one way of looking at that may be that it's a kind of a almost like a face-saving thing where, you know, you could have like a show of deference, so the nuns could come up and say, oh yes, Bhante, and sadhu, 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 and pay respects to the monks. But then having made the show of deference, they can then go off and do what they like. Yeah? So that these things, when they're actually working out in a community and in life, are much more subtle and much more complex than they appear to be from just the texts themselves. So when the Bhikkhuni Sangha was established, grew during the Buddha's lifetime, and then continued after the Buddha passed away. Now, we don't have all that much record of the Bhikkhuni community in ancient India. We do have some mentions. The most important facts that we know is that in the time of King Ashoka, of course King Ashoka lived about 150 years after the Buddha and was the great Buddhist emperor of all of India. And his empire was the largest empire in the world at that time, and he ruled that for many decades with a very strict non-violence policy. And so he was one of the greatest emperors in the world. If you haven't heard of King Ashoka and you don't know his story, you really should do, and go and look it up on Wikipedia or something like that. And it's a very, very moving story. Now, one of the things that King Ashoka did was that he spread Buddhism through different parts of the world, including to Sri Lanka. And the mission, King Ashoka's son Mahinda went to Sri Lanka in that period, and then following that he sent his daughter Sanghamitta, who was a bhikkhuni. And Sanghamitta took with her the Bodhi tree, which was a sapling from the original tree under which the Buddha became enlightened. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that a sapling of that same Bodhi tree is here at Nolamar, is that correct? Do you have a sapling from the Bodhi tree here? Yeah. So this was brought by Bhikkhuni Sanghamitta. And when that was brought to Sri Lanka, and of course that became the center for the devotional practice of Buddhism in Sri Lanka, and remains so today. That tree is still alive. It's the oldest historical tree in existence, and is very, obviously very old and frail now, but is one of the most important symbols of that direct connection with Buddhism. And that was brought over the seas by Bhikkhuni Sanghamitta. And then she established the Bhikkhuni order in Sri Lanka. Now, there's sketchy records of what happened after that, but it seems that the Bhikkhuni survived in Sri Lanka until about the 12th century. So that's probably close to 1,500 years or so. And at that time, there was a lot of dissension, war, conflict in Sri Lanka, and the Sangha was decimated. And when sort of things were put back together again, the bhikkhunis were nowhere to be seen. So we don't really know exactly what happened to the bhikkhunis in that period, but we do know that in following periods they're not heard of again. So it seems that they survived in Sri Lanka for about 1,500 years. There are occasional hints of bhikkhuni communities in Burma and Thailand during that period, but no real solid evidence. Although, interestingly enough, there are some king's edicts from Burma dated 1810 around 1810, which refer to bhikkhunis existing in Burma even at that late date. So there quite possibly were some bhikkhunis around, but not very much records of them. Now, for what happened, one of the most interesting thing or important things that then happened was that in the year 433, a ship owned by a fellow, a merchant called Nandin, travelled from Sri Lanka to China. And at that time, there was quite a lot of trade and cultural connections between Sri Lanka and Eastern Asia and with China. And they took some bhikkhunis with them. And that was led by a bhikkhuni whose name was Sara. And so this bhikkhuni Sara, together with a group of Sri Lankan bhikkhunis, ordained some Chinese nuns and gave them the bhikkhuni ordination. And that happened in 433. So since then, the bhikkhuni order then spread through China, Korea, Vietnam, partially also in Japan, although not so much anymore, Taiwan, and so generally the East Asian area. In India, we have quite a lot of inscriptions and records of bhikkhunis through the early centuries AD. And you find it's interesting that you find mentions of bhikkhunis about the same frequency as mentions of bhikkhus, and that they appear in similar roles. So they appear as teachers, as sponsors for, say, the building of stupas and large building projects. So it seems that the bhikkhunis had a prominent and strong role in Indian Buddhism during most of the time of Buddhism in India, and eventually, of course, died out as Buddhism in India died out. When Buddhism went to Tibet, and around 7th, 8th centuries, the bhikkhuni order did not go there, and although there are occasional references to bhikkhuni communities in the Tibetan cultural sphere, generally speaking, there was never an established and accepted bhikkhuni sangha within Tibetan Buddhism. So in the Buddhism which we've inherited today from the different Buddhist traditions, only within the East Asian traditions do we find the bhikkhuni sangha, so Chinese, Taiwan, Korea, Vietnam. In other countries, especially the Theravadan countries, we find, which is like Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka and so on, we find that the countries there have evolved their own kind of substitute forms for female renunciates. So in different countries there'll be different things. Say in Thailand they have what they call the mechi, which you may have seen if you've been in Thailand or familiar with Thai Buddhism. They usually wear white, have a shaven head, and stay in the monasteries and so on. So this is a kind of a nun's form for, it's been evolved in Thailand. And there are similar things have developed in Burma and Sri Lanka and so on. So there is some opportunity for women to practice who wish to practice a renunciate life, but it's very limited. And typically the women in those situations do not get the respect and the support that the bhikkhus do. And you very often will find that the women have to spend all their time just cooking and cleaning for the monks. Okay, so they go and ordain as nuns, and actually they spend a lot of their time doing the cooking and all of the domestic chores and so on. It's very, this is something I've seen myself as a monk. I went to a monastery in the south of Thailand once, and I was staying there for a few days. Came up to the main building, I needed to wash my robes, and there was this old nun there, this old mechi, and I just said to her, just looking for some detergent so I can wash my robes. And she said, I'll wash them for you. So I said, that's fine, I'll just wash my robes myself. No, I'll wash them for you. No, really, if you could just give me some detergent, I will wash them for you. okay. So I had to surrender on that little one. And so this is like a very much a self-image, yeah? It's not just something that's imposed, but something that becomes internalized. The role of a nun is to look after the monks, to cook, to clean, to do the laundry, all of those things. And interestingly enough, actually in the Vinaya, laid down by the Buddha, the nuns are forbidden from doing those things for the monks. Okay, they can't cook for the monks. They can't do the laundry for the monks. Okay, they can't go to the nuns and say, sew my robes for me, all of these things. They're all forbidden. Okay, and so clearly the presence of those rules shows us that these issues also were alive in the time of the Buddha, that there was always the possibility that the women's community would be exploited and turned into basically domestic servants for the monks' communities. And so the Buddha didn't want that to happen. So there are many things which we find within the bhikkhuni's vinaya which actually serve as a protection and a support for the women's communities. And it's very important to remember this. Sometimes when this issue is discussed, that I mentioned before the Garu Dhammas and the rule that the nuns have to bow to the monks and so on. And so people assume from that the bhikkhuni's vinaya code, monastic code, makes the bhikkhunis subservient to the bhikkhus, okay? And that's very kind of black and white. In fact, it's much more nuanced than that. And there are some important areas where the bhikkhunis are very much protected and supported from exploitation by unscrupulous monks and in various other ways as well. So that the practice of the vinaya is, in my opinion, is a very important means to ensure that the women within the renunciate community can continue to practice and to develop with respect and with in a manner which is suitable for a Buddhist renunciate. So, as I said, in these different traditions, different countries, these different forms have evolved. Now, the fact that those forms are there tells us that, in a sense, there's a vacuum. Okay, there's a need in each of those countries, yeah, and for women to practice the renunciate life. And of course, I'm sure all of you are familiar with, if you come here, I haven't. It's a bit too many people to do a head count, but usually if you're giving a Buddhist retreat or something like that, usually there's about four times as many women as there are men, yeah? Now, I don't know what the count is here tonight. Someone maybe want to count for us and see who's more. So typically there's more women than men. And so when I was in Thailand, I asked the people about that. I asked this layman who came to the monastery, why is it that there's always more women than men coming to the monastery? And so this layman said, but it's because the men are always working all day. Really? I said, they're working hard. It seemed to me that the women work pretty hard sometimes too. And that's one point of view on it. And then I asked one of the women, why is it that there's always more women coming to the monastery than men? And she said, oh, it's because the men all go to the brothels and go gambling. So perhaps a bit of truth to both of those. Anyway, so we have a lot of interest from women in spiritual practice, in Buddhism. And this is everywhere. Every culture you go to is the same. And so we need to provide that means for some women who wish to practice a renunciate life. Now, as I said before, the different countries evolved some kind of platform that will enable that. But those platforms, generally speaking, are not all that satisfactory. They fulfill a certain role within that culture, but they're unsatisfactory for many reasons. Partly, as I said, they don't allow the nuns' communities to be protected, to practice properly. But also another very important problem is that they're divided, so that each country you go to will have a different kind of system. And so you actually end up with different kinds of nuns' orders everywhere you go to. So it's very differentiated, as opposed to the monks. And so with the bhikkhus, we all ordain under the same vinaya. So even though we recognize that there are surface differences in the color of the robes we wear and so on, but the basic ordination platform and the code of conduct we follow is the same. So we recognize this uniformity and unity among the bhikkhus from different traditions. So, for example, when I went to Bodhinyana just now, you know, we had the community and there are some monks who've ordained in Bodhinyana. There are others there's a couple of Korean monks who have come there now. and they come and they, as long as they're practicing with the community there, they come and join in with the Sangha, another monk I think ordained in Sri Lanka or Burma or somewhere. And so they come and they can integrate easily within the community because we have this recognized platform of ordination. For the nuns, they don't have that. They have different ordination platforms everywhere. And so that tends to fracture, fragment and weaken the nuns' community, which of course is already weak. Yeah. So this is one important reason why the bhikkhuni platform is important. The other reason that the bhikkhuni platform is important is because the most basic important reason, really, I was sitting around discussing this particular issue a few years ago. We had a conference on bhikkhunis called the, I think it was called the Bhikkhuni Women's Ordination Congress in Hamburg, and that was held with the Dalai Lama. And the main question they wanted to discuss was about the introduction of bhikkhuni ordination into the Tibetan tradition. And of course the Dalai Lama is personally very supportive of this. So we had meetings with the Dalai Lama and so on. And one discussion that we were having with some of the nuns there, there were nuns from different backgrounds who were giving different reasons why it was or was not good to do bhikkhuni ordination. And one of the nuns who was a bhikkhuni there just sort of said very quietly, but isn't it just what the Buddha wanted? Yeah, isn't this what he set up for us, and shouldn't that be enough? So really that to me that quiet faith lies at the heart of the real reason, the real emotional connection, which is where bhikkhuni ordination is coming from. When the Buddha gave the going forth to the women and wanted to support them, this is how he wanted them to live. And so he accepted them within his community and gave them guidelines for the conduct which in all essential areas are very similar to the guidelines for the bhikkhus. And so when we undertake that training, it's a very powerful thing. It's quite an extraordinary thing. You know, I can still remember my time in Thailand was it 1994 when I took my full ordination. And, you know, it's a very solemn event, yeah? And I'm sure you've all seen, or many of you have seen, the ordinations that have been done here, the novice ordinations or the monks' ordinations done in Bodhinyana. And, you know, you have the monks all kind of gathered together and you recite the words of the ordination procedure in Pali. And it's quite an extraordinary thing. There's this something about entering into that community, that fully ordained community, which is very empowering and quite extraordinary. You can't put it into words, but it has something to do with that feeling of connection. Connection with the community around you in the present moment, but also connection with the wider community around the world. We have this idea of the community of the four directions. Yeah, so the universal community and also the community of past, present and future. Yeah, so that we can connect in that very, very deep way with the greater Sangha. And that is only available through taking bhikkhu ordination or bhikkhuni ordination in the Buddhist context. Everything else is going to be in some way a diminishing of that, a lessening of that. And I discussed this issue a few years ago with Ajahn Suchito from England. And Ajahn Suchito from the Chithurst Monastery in England was the monk who was instrumental in setting up the nun's order in England. And they also set up under a 10-precept model, like a Samanera model, similar to Dhammasara. And he organized that during the 1980s. They set that up, and that was quite a breakthrough at the time. It was a great step forward to be able to establish this, and he always saw this as a stepping stone towards bhikkhuni ordination. When I was talking about it with him a couple of years ago, he said, you know, which really is more inspiring, to undertake the bhikkhuni ordination according to the platform established by the Buddha 2,500 years ago, or to take a ordination according to the 10-precept platform established 20 years ago by me? So that's really the thing, is that joining that community and that sangha in the fullest sense. So this is one of also the great reasons, very powerful reasons for taking the bhikkhuni ordination. It's not something you can quantify. It's not something you can rationally evaluate. It's that feeling of inspiration. So this is one thing. Second thing which is very important is the fact that with the bhikkhuni ordination you have a much more complete training. And you know, sometimes people have this impression that the Buddhist monastic training is kind of really difficult or really hard or it's a burden or something like that. It's not true at all. And those of us who live it every day and who actually practice these things, you realize what an incredible support it is and how powerful and meaningful it is to be able to live your life in this way. The Buddhist monastic code is not at all a sort of an ironclad straitjacket that kind of restricts your spiritual life and doesn't allow your development to, you know, to be who you are. It's not like that at all. Buddhist monastic code is actually, in fact, very gentle, very flexible, and very adaptable, and it gives a sense of a set of guidelines and principles which are quite extraordinary in their kind of applicability and reasonableness. You know, and remember, this is 500 BC we're talking about, you know. I mean, if you compare it with the other law codes that were going on at the time, you know, the tortures that they would give people, and you know, they would be chopping people's heads off and chopping their hands off and all kinds of things. And the Buddhist legal code, you know, the most things you just confess it, that's all. And the worst possible punishment you can have is to be asked to leave the community. That's the big punishment, is simply to be asked to leave. So the Buddhist monastic code is very, very gentle and very, very reasonable and very fair. Everything is open, everything is democratic, everything's decided by the community. And one of the things that does, as well as giving the internal support in the bhikkhuni community to actually have those guidelines for practice, but even more importantly, or at least as importantly, it also specifies certain relationships and connections between the bhikkhu community and the bhikkhuni community. Okay, and so some of these I've mentioned before. It means the bhikkhus can't say, "Sister, take my robes and go and do the laundry for me." Okay, you can't do that. And so you're forced, the bhikkhus are forced to treat the bhikkhunis in a way as equals, in a relationship of respect, mutual respect. So this is very, very important. Now this is something which you might not notice so much here in Perth. Yeah? Okay, you're very lucky here. It's a privileged Buddhist community. You've got a beautiful Buddhist centre, you've got a beautiful nunnery, a beautiful monks' monastery, and a beautiful new meditation centre. You can think you've got it made, right? And if you want to, you could be like the selfish arahants, okay? So you know the Theravadins sometimes get accused of being selfish. So you could be a bunch of selfish arahants if you like, and say, "We've got what we want. We don't care about anybody else." Yeah. But that's not the proper spirit of Buddhism. Yeah. I think it's important, you know, to look for yourselves, to look at what you have here in terms of the communities, the monks community, nuns community, and all of those things. You realize that that mutual relationship of support, which is so apparent here, that the flourishing of the monks community and nuns community also means the flourishing of the lay community as well. Yeah, and I think we can all see that here tonight. These things work together, the more we can support that. That's not the case in many places that we can see, and many places that I go to regularly in Buddhism, where you see lay communities who become estranged from the monastic community, who don't see the relevance of the monastic community, who have never really experienced what it's like to have the monks and nuns practicing well. When you see people who have never seen nuns living and practicing properly in Buddhism, and so don't have any idea of that, And so there's all these kind of fractured, incomplete forms of Buddhism which we encounter. So here in Perth, and at BSWA, I think you can play an important role as a role model for Buddhism in other places. And I think this is an important thing to reflect on as we move forward, that what we're practicing here is connected, yeah, with what's going on in other places. It's connected with what's happening at our monastery, at Santi Monastery. It's connected with when Ajahn Brahm goes to Singapore and teaches there. It's connected when somebody downloads one of Ajahn Brahm's talks in Finland or something like that and listens to it. All these connections with your friends, your family in different places, many of you will have relatives in different countries and so on. All of these connections in different parts of the world. And so we're a part of that. The choices that we make here will influence what happens in those places. What we've seen in the last few years is the emergence of a very small, but quite a strong and vibrant bhikkhuni sangha within the Theravadan world. And this movement started in the 1990s and gathered momentum in the mid to late 90s with some large ordinations of bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka. Some of the ordinations performed in India, largely with Sri Lankan bhikkhunis, with some from other places as well. And so in the last few years, there's been some quite strong bhikkhuni monasteries established in Sri Lanka with their own training procedures and so on. And that's been quite successful. I think there's several hundred bhikkhunis now in Sri Lanka. When I was in Bodh Gaya recently, a year or two ago, I was talking with Bhante Sivali at the Mahabodhi Society there, and a Sri Lankan monk, and I asked him how just making conversation, I said, how's Sangha going in Sri Lanka? How's Buddhism flourishing there? He said, oh, very bad. He said, now, Sangha's in decline, monks disrobing, not very good at all. And he said, the only thing he said, most people now, a lot of people prefer to go to the bhikkhunis than to the bhikkhus. So if they do their house dana or they want the chanting, then they prefer to invite the bhikkhunis along because they're better practiced than the bhikkhus. And so maybe this is one reason why some of the bhikkhus not comfortable with having the bhikkhunis around. But anyway, I'll leave that to one side for now. So in Sri Lanka, there's been some opposition, and some people take a while to get used to these things, but after a while the bhikkhuni nunnery starts and it goes on, and what happens? The world doesn't fall down. In Thailand, Bhikkhuni Dhammananda, some of you may remember from the global conference, she was here. She was one of the first bhikkhunis ordained in Thailand, and since then there's been quite a few now. I'm not exactly sure of the numbers, but I think maybe 30 or 40 bhikkhunis now in Thailand at maybe 6 or 7 different centres throughout Thailand. The interesting thing is that one often hears it said, if you listen to what's being said among the Sangha and so on, people say that Thai Sangha doesn't accept bhikkhunis. Yeah? And so this is something that you hear. It's like a piece of common knowledge. But my experience has been quite different. My experience has been when I've been in Thailand that, for example, when I visited my teacher, Ajahn Mahachatchai, who I learnt metta meditation from, that we did a little bit earlier, the metta meditation. And when I was staying there, we were visited by some of the Thai nuns who were wearing the ochre robes. And this was the first time at that monastery, the first time that they'd seen that. Yeah, they'd only ever seen the white robe made cheese before. So the first time they'd actually seen the nuns wearing the ochre robes. And it was very delightful for me to see because all the lay people there were so happy to see them running around, bowing to them and going around getting some drinks to offer them and, you know, treating them very, very kindly and very respectfully. And this nun was talking with my teacher, Ajahn Mahachatchai, and he said, oh, how do you know Ajahn Sujato? And she said, oh, I think, you know, he does a lot of work for helping nuns. I think most of the nuns know him. And Ajahn Chachai said, oh, that's because he's very even-minded and doesn't have discrimination. So that made me feel very, very warm to have that kind of thing said about me by my teacher. And just to have that recognition that it's not about, you know, anything other than just not discriminating. Just because people are women, then they have that chance to practice. So this is my experience of the reception of bhikkhunis and nuns within the Thai Sangha. And I've also heard this many times from the nuns living in Thailand, that they say that they've always had a wonderful time in the monasteries and with the monks there, that it hadn't been a problem. I was making some inquiries recently as to, you know, what actually is the situation in Thailand, because there seems to be this idea that the Thai Sangha doesn't accept bhikkhunis. And so only recently I found out from somebody very highly placed within the Thai hierarchy, within the council, very closely connected with the Council of Elders in Thailand, and he said that actually the Thai Sangha doesn't have any policy regarding bhikkhunis. So I said, what is the official Thai position? What do they officially say? And he said, well, officially they don't say anything. So actually in Thailand there's no official, as far as I'm aware, there's no official policy regarding bhikkhunis. Okay, they just don't say anything. It's a very kind of Buddhist or something way of doing things, and so you're neither favouring nor opposing. But in practice, the bhikkhunis are there and they're getting on with their lives and so on. Similarly, in Cambodia, there's a community of about 20 bhikkhunis supported by one of the leaders of the Sangha there. In Indonesia, there's two bhikkhunis there, very wonderful bhikkhunis, Santini and Silavati, who are again establishing their monastery and developing it. In America, there's a number of bhikkhuni centres some of them established and ordained under the care of Bhante Gunaratana. And many of you, of course, would know Bhante Gunaratana, or Bhanteji, and he's visited here many times. And he's been a great supporter of bhikkhunis for the last several years and has ordained quite a few there. One of his students, of course, Aya Suchinta, has set up a monastery in Melbourne, Sanghamitta Rama. And in addition, there's places in Germany and other places around the world. So in all of these places, you're seeing the setting up of a community, an international community of bhikkhunis. Yeah? And so in moving towards joining that community, you know, we're moving towards a situation where for women renunciates, they will have a network, yeah? They will have teachers. As the community gets more established, then obviously they'll become more mature and more spiritual depth in the community. There'll be greater chances for them to travel, which is very important. Like one of the things with the bhikkhus is that, you know, if you're staying in a bhikkhu monastery, if you don't like it, you go somewhere else, right? And for the nuns, what do? You don't like it, there isn't anywhere else to go, yeah, or very few places. So it's very important that there's a network and an international network. So this is what we want to do, is to try to move towards that situation where the women will have those things which we, as bhikkhus, as monks, take completely for granted, okay? And we don't notice that the women just don't have these things. They don't have the opportunity to meet great teachers. They don't have the opportunity to go and practice in seclusion if they wish to. They don't have the benefit of an existing community and culture which teaches them how to practice, how to behave, and so on. So all of these things which I think among the monks we sometimes take for granted and don't notice enough how the women have all of those difficulties and sufferings which they have to overcome. So I think it's very important that we help to support them to do that, and to move towards an environment, a culture of Buddhism, which we will develop in Australia as part of the international culture of Buddhism, where there's an equity between monks and nuns with the support of the lay community. And so this, I think, will be an important aspect of how Buddhism will grow and develop in our culture. If we can't do that, I think we're going to fail. I have to be honest. I think if we can't do that, then Buddhism doesn't really have a long-term future in countries like Australia. You know, we'll be a kind of a short-term cultural import, and then after a while it will wither away and die. So I think this is something which we really need to address and look at. So I've been talking for probably too long already this evening, so I'd like to open up now if there's any comments or questions, or if anyone doesn't have any comments and questions, maybe they might have some good jokes to share with us. Ajahn Brahm's not here tonight, so... That one, okay. Yeah. The seven Garudhammas, crikey. In brief, most of them refer to, most of them are not as controversial as the first one, and most of them refer to the coordination of particular formal, what we call sanghakama, is a formal act of the sangha between the bhikkhus and bhikkhuni sangha. So that means, for example, on the you may be familiar, for example, with the uposatha ceremony, the fortnightly recitation of the rules. So then there's a provision for a meeting between the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis on that uposatha, and so that's a rule laid down for that. And so at different events and stages in life of the monastics, like ordination and so on, there's provision for like coordinating the bhikkhu and bhikkhuni's communities at those points. So most of the Garudhammas are together with that, and a couple of the others are to do with criticizing and abusing. So this, the bhikkhunis are not allowed to criticize and abuse the bhikkhus. Okay, and of course that's a normal thing of right speech anyway, but it's mentioned there. Yeah. Why did the Buddha say, don't ask for ordination? Well, as I said before, I don't think the Buddha actually said that, okay? What have we got? We've got a text, okay? We've got several texts, so we can read the text and we can make an inference from that text as to what we think a historical situation may have been, but we don't really know what that was. You know, and we put it in perspective, you know, we can read the newspaper. What was said yesterday in Parliament? Yeah, and you can read three different newspapers and get three different accounts of what they said. Yeah, so when we're inferring what happened in India 2,500 years ago, we have to keep a certain humility as to what we know. So I personally don't think the Buddha said that. There's another very interesting little sutta, little passage where one of the nuns, Bhadda Kundalakesa, refers to her own ordination, and she says that when she met the Buddha in Rajagaha, the Buddha said, "Ehi Bhadda, come Bhadda," and that was her full ordination. Yeah? So this is another style of ordination which the Buddha used for the bhikkhus in the early years of his teaching. And instead of the elaborate ordination procedure, he'd just say, "Come, monk, live the holy life for the full ending of suffering." And so this one nun, Bhadda, her ordination was done in that way, in the same way. So I found it quite interesting. It's a very different emotional kind of connotation there. Yeah, come Bhadda, live the holy life. Yeah, it's very different from that thing of don't ask for ordination. But in terms of that particular story, why does that say no, don't ask? Well, my feeling is, and this is just my thoughts on the matter, is that the problem really was with Mahapajapati as the Buddha's foster mother. She, one thing that we know was that the Buddha's family were renowned for their pride. Okay, so everyone would know that. Anyone, if you come from a traditional Buddhist background, you know that the Sakyan family are notorious for being very proud and very arrogant, okay, and that in fact caused their death. They were destroyed because of their pride. And we only hear of the Buddha's foster mother, Mahapajapati, twice in the period before she ordained. One of those events, she came to the Buddha with some robes, and she said to the Buddha, "Please, here, accept these robes." Yeah. Now, what do you think the Buddha would do? Yeah, his foster mother's come and offered the robes, yeah, to him. I mean, you've seen people offering robes to the monks and so on before, and what do? You say, "Oh, okay, that's very kind, you just offer them," and that's what the Buddha did. But in this case, he didn't say that, right? He said, no, don't offer the robes to me, offer the robes to the Sangha. Yeah? And she wanted to offer the robes to him, and he said, no, offer the robes to the Sangha. So what exactly is going on there? Well, seems obvious that what's happened is that she has this very personal attachment to the Buddha as her son, her stepson. She raised him and suckled him as a baby. And so she's still got that very personal feeling of attachment for him. And he's trying to say, well, no, 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 you've got to respect the Sangha as a whole, right? And you can see, of course, that that dynamic would easily develop in a community, yeah? If you've got, you know, she's from the aristocratic family in the Sakyan Republic, it would be very easy to have kind of problems arising from the fact that she felt sort of somehow superior to the monks or something like that. So when she came to ask ordination, which may have been on the same occasion or it may have been a later occasion, she came to ask for ordination and the same thing, like the Buddha's insisting that she pay respects to the monks. Yeah? So I suspect that maybe these rules, or that rule about bowing, was originally established for Mahapajapati. It was her rule, special rule for her, remembering that the Buddha never laid down rules without a reason. It's one absolute principle all through the Vinaya. Every time the Buddha would refuse to lay down any kind of rule until there was a reason, right? And so in this is the only time in the Vinaya where he lays down a rule without any reason, right? So rather than thinking that the Buddha acted so far out of character in this case, maybe I think more plausible to think that he had actually a very good reason, which was the pride of Mahapajapati, and that he laid down the rule in order to curb her pride and to make sure that she paid due respects to the Sangha. But again, I just mentioned this. This is just my own theory about it. So, encourage you to get hold of the account and read it and read some of this. There's been some interesting work and analysis done on that particular passage in modern times. So I encourage you to have a look at that. So no one's got any good jokes for us?
Excuse me, I'm young. What I was thinking then is that the suffragettes in the UK had the same sort of problem that you were talking about.
Uh-huh.
They won through in the end, so I think this would win as well.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Yeah, I think, like the suffragettes or whoever. And in a sense, if you sort of step back a little bit and just sort of look at how society has evolved and changed over the years, you can see this is obviously a very long-term, very broad-based thing. I mean, we're discussing similar issues within Buddhism. You obviously have the same debate going on in the Catholic Church, among the Muslims and the Jews and so on. They all have the same issues. The specific way that it's formulated will differ, but certainly the issues themselves are the same, and basic issues. In some ways, we're very lucky in Buddhism that the one thing which is very clear is that the Buddha did say, and no one contests this, that the Buddha did say that there's no difference in the spiritual capacity of men and women. And in that same passage where the Buddha allegedly was reluctant to ordain Mahapajapati, he was persuaded on the basis that the women were capable of full enlightenment, yeah, so were capable of becoming arahants. And so that's really a critical point. You know, there's no suggestion anywhere in Buddhism that there's a kind of an actual spiritual difference between men and women, which again makes it all the more puzzling why there would be any kind of reluctance to ordain women. There's actually a beautiful verse in the Sanyutta Nikaya. One of the bhikkhunis is approached by Mara. So Mara in Buddhism is like the tempter. He's like the kind of Satan figure, and he's the devil of Buddhism. So Mara used to like to come and annoy people when they were meditating or something like that. So one time he came to this bhikkhuni who was meditating by herself in the forest. And he said to her, why do you even bother trying to meditate? You know, you're just a weak woman. Yeah, you've just got two-fingered wisdom. Right, so two-fingered wisdom means you can't really grasp things properly. Yeah, so if you're really wise, you can grasp it. Yeah, you know, women is like, oh, you're gonna like that. So you only got two-fingered wisdom. So why even bother trying to this hard spiritual practice? And so this is Mara, of course, yeah? This is the Buddha's great opponent. He's the one who's saying that women have the weak wisdom and can't practice. Yeah? And so the bhikkhuni's response was to say, I know you, Mara, right? You're Mara, the evil one who's come to disturb me and take me away from my meditation. She says, you know, I don't have any thought of man or woman. Yeah? Anyone who thinks about I am a man or I'm a woman, then you go off and talk to them. Okay, so Mara, go and talk to someone who thinks I'm a man or I'm a woman or I'm anything at all, right? But she said when one's conduct is pure, when one's mind is concentrated and peaceful, and when you see the truth with insight, then where do the ideas of man and women occur in that? Yeah. So this is very, very powerful, I think, very powerful verses. And I really have to say that I don't think, you know, we've had 2,500 years of supposedly cultural evolution since then, and all the modern debates about feminism and equal rights and so on. I don't think anyone said it any better. Yeah. Yep.
What are the actual upcoming plans for bhikkhunis in this tradition?
For producing bhikkhunis in the tradition? Well, we're setting up a factory and... We're actually going to be outsourcing to China. I shouldn't joke about that. That's what we've actually been doing is outsourcing to China so far. And at Sandi Monastery, we've been getting our like Chinese takeaway bhikkhunis because we can. So, but like Chinese takeaway generally doesn't really satisfy your hunger. So far, like I say, at of course here at Dhammasari we have the 10 precept nuns. At Santi we've had a mixture, some seminaries we've ordained ourselves and also some bhikkhunis who've ordained elsewhere in Sri Lanka or Taiwan or something, and then they've come and they're practicing according to the forest tradition way of practice. And so this is how we've been doing it so far. And we've always had the plan to do bhikkhuni ordination, and Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Wayama have had the intention to do that as well. So now we're looking to coordinate that and hold a bhikkhuni ordination, which will be hopefully the first Theravadan bhikkhuni ordination in Australia. And so the plans for this are not confirmed yet, but we're hoping to do something next year. So if you stay tuned and listen to the announcements as they come up, we're hoping to do the first bhikkhuni ordination in Perth next year. Yeah. Yep.
Can I just ask, is there much resistance to bhikkhuni ordination? Is there much resistance? I suppose I say this coming from a Catholic background.
Uh-huh. Yeah, of course, similar issues come up. And yes, there is resistance from various points and around various issues. One problem which is often raised and which is a serious question, which you know... I mean, some of the questions are really... See, the problem is, of course, that the real resistance comes up from, you know, prejudice, cultural bias, unconscious kind of forces, you know, unresolved issues and so on, which... are things which are difficult to debate in a public forum, yeah. And so very often we find that there's simply an absence, and this has been for me the main thing that's characterised the debate. Like if you go and Google bhikkhuni ordination or something, you'll find a few hundred references to bhikkhuni ordination in a positive way, and you won't really find anything that's negative about it, because the negativity doesn't happen in public forums. The negativity is in a way is hidden. It's a voice of silence, a voice of absence, rather than an actual contribution. But in terms of the actual kind of specific objections to bhikkhuni ordination, the most common one that you hear is that the ordination lineage was broken, and that because there's no bhikkhunis to form perform the ordination, therefore there's no lineage. Now it's important to notice what kind of argument is being said here. Yeah? I mean, it's a very kind of legalistic thing, isn't it? Yeah? It's nothing to do with, well, here is the most positive way that we can find within the Buddhist tradition to respond to the genuine spiritual needs of women, yeah, by doing this. It's like saying, well, we've got this legalistic dot and dash which we can't, you know, quite figure out. So to my mind, that kind of objection is already betraying a lack of sort of serious spiritual engagement with the issues. It's not actually addressing the problem. It's also dependent on a rather curious assumption, which is what is the bhikkhu's ordination lineage, for example? Yeah. So, I mean, I got ordination in Thailand. I was there, right? I know what happened there. There was a bunch of monks there. I don't know what happened at their ordinations, right? Were their ordinations conducted properly? I hope so, yeah? And what about the ones who ordained them and them and the one? What evidence do we have that there is a legitimate bhikkhu's ordination lineage that goes back 2,500 years? And quite frankly, the evidence is none at all, right? There's precisely no reasonable historical basis for assuming that there's a bhikkhu ordination lineage that goes back all that time. We do it out of faith, that's all. We have a faith that we're entering into that community. And if we look at the way that ordination is described in the Vinaya, okay, it doesn't actually talk about ordination lineages as such. The purpose of the ordination is not so much to ensure a lineage as to ensure the support and the education of the candidate. That's the concern that the Vinaya itself has. Is the candidate a suitable candidate? Are they going to be practicing well? Are they going to be have the proper teachings? Are they going to have the requisites that they need, and so on? So it's about the actual looking after the person who's come to ordain. Now, with the bhikkhunis and starting the bhikkhuni ordination again, then the traditional response, or one traditional response from the Theravadan community, is that there's no Theravadan bhikkhunis. Okay, therefore we can't do the Theravadan bhikkhuni ordination. Now, there's two. If we take this response seriously, there's two ways around that. Firstly is that in the Vinaya, it gives an explicit and clear allowance for bhikkhus to perform bhikkhuni ordination by themselves. Okay, and that's black and white. It says, I allow monks for bhikkhus to perform the bhikkhuni ordination. Okay, that's what it just says in the Vinaya. So there's no doubt that within the Pali Vinaya, it's fully acceptable for the bhikkhus to perform ordination for the women, if necessary. This is one point. Second point is that, as I mentioned before, that the bhikkhuni lineage was taken from Sri Lanka to China in 433, where it was established and flourished to the present day. Now, within a traditional Theravadan perspective, we often conceive of Theravadan Buddhism is quite distinct from what we call Mahayana Buddhism. Okay, so we have like two schools of Buddhism, Theravada and Mahayana, and we see them as quite separate. Yeah? That division or that distinction only applies in terms of, to the extent that it's valid in any case, but it only applies really in terms of the certain philosophical doctrines, certain scriptures, and so on, which are accepted as being Mahayanist. And also it applies in terms of cultural differences that have evolved in Buddhism in different countries. Yeah? So, for example, in China and Tibet, when the bhikkhus and when the monks and nuns went there, they tried to keep the rule that we follow about only eating in the morning. Yeah? So, you know, that we don't eat in the afternoon. So when they went to China, they tried not eating in the afternoon, but they were just freezing cold in the evenings because they're living up in the mountains and it's snowy. Yeah? This is a rule which made sense in the tropical climate in India. So for years in China, they actually used to heat river pebbles and eat them in the afternoon. Yeah, so that they could stay warm. That's the only way they could stay warm. After a while, somebody said, this is getting silly, right? So they said, okay, We'll have some rice and we'll eat that in the afternoon, okay? And we'll call it hot rocks. So this is what they eat. They eat in the afternoon hot rocks in the Chinese tradition, yeah? So this is how these differences evolve. It's not a fundamental division. So these distinctions between Theravada and Mahayana, that's how they apply. But they don't apply in terms of the actual monastic lineage. Okay, and this is very important to understand this distinction. There's no Mahayana monastic or ordination lineage, and there never has been. Mahayana is not a monastic, it's got nothing to do with the monastic lineage. The Mahayana is a philosophical teaching or a practical teaching about how to you know, values and so on, but it's not about how the monastics actually lived. And even in ancient India, all of the monks and nuns in ancient India ordained under the Vinaya tradition of the early schools of Buddhism, okay, and of which the Theravada is one. Okay, so there's a variety of early schools. And that situation remained the same when Buddhism went to China and when it went to Tibet. So in China and the whole East Asian sphere, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis ordain under a Vinaya which is called the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. In the Tibetan sphere, they ordain under a Vinaya called the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. Okay? Now, these are names of ancient schools of Buddhism. Now, the schools themselves don't exist anymore as such. Okay? But their ordination lineages have been kept down through these cultural traditions. And if you're interested to have a look more in detail at the history of these things, you can have a look. I wrote a book a few years ago called Sects and Sectarianism. I have to be very careful how I pronounce this. And you can Google this and find it on the web. I was actually introduced, I did this talk a while ago at this interfaith thing, and they introduced me. Here's Bhante Sujato. He's the author of A Swift Pair of Messages, History of Mindfulness, and Sects and Secretaries. And it was quite funny because the lady doing the announcement had obviously just come from work. It was a weeknight. And she had the whole kind of sexy secretary look about, you know, short skirts and power shoulders and everything. And it was... Anyway, I sort of gently kind of corrected her. She said, I thought there was something a bit funny about that. So sects and sectarianism. And... in there I talk about this history. And in fact, the interesting thing I found out through doing all of that study was that these different schools, the Dharmaguptaka, Mula Sarvastivada and the Theravadan tradition, are actually very, very closely linked in ancient India itself. And they actually stem from a very closely knit circle of monks around the time of King Ashoka. So they're very, very closely related traditions. And this is to me quite an interesting finding historically. And so the Dharmaguptaka school established in China, Korea, Vietnam, and so on, the Vinaya, the suttas, the teachings, everything about that particular school is basically identical with what we find in the Theravadan school. There's no differences at all. Any differences that we see between modern-day Theravadan bhikkhus and Mahayana is almost all because of the cultural differences that have arisen during that period of time. And that's why, as I mentioned before, we have the Korean bhikkhus now staying in Bodhinyana Monastery, and they're accepted by the Sangha there because they recognize the unity of the traditions there. So this is that one question. One problem which is often raised is that there's no ordination lineage, but from a historical point of view, we'd have to say that there is an ordination lineage, and that I don't see any intrinsic problem with introducing that into the Theravadan tradition. Now, in terms of the, you know, you mentioned the question of the resistance to bhikkhuni ordination. I think this is something which, I think within my experience of Buddhism in Thailand, and I mentioned before, I think, first of all, I think that there's a diversity of response. Okay, so I don't think there's a kind of monolithic Theravadan view on any of these things. Actually, I speak to different monks and so on about this all the time, and they have different points of view about it. Yeah, and Theravada doesn't have a kind of a central orthodoxy that determines how everybody thinks. This is not a reality. It's not a real world perception. If those of you were at the Global Buddhist Conference a few years ago, one of the things I really remember from there was Patrick Carney made the statement. He said a tradition is not like a kind of a received set of agreed upon dogmas, but it's more like a family argument. Yeah, I don't know if you remember that thing he used. I think that was a wonderful example. You know, it's like family Christmas. You know, that's what a tradition is. You get together, you sit around, you're all very nice to each other for a while, and then the wine starts to flow, and then after a little while, you start to argue about exactly the same things you argued about last year. Yeah. And that's what it isn't. So this is one of the things that we argue about in Theravada Buddhism. We argue about samatha and vipassana. We argue ajahn is necessary for enlightenment. We argue about dependent origination. And we argue about bhikkhunis. That's what it means to be Theravadan. But we care. See, this reason you argue about it is because you care. Yeah? So if we didn't care, we wouldn't argue. My feeling is that these things, in a sense, is a bit of a, it's a bit. They just we're kind of time passes, and then we kind of forget that it was a problem. You know, you just kind of do it, and then after a while, people see the main thing that will actually persuade people will be the practice, and certainly, I think from the Thai tradition and the Thai forest tradition. Very much so within the Thai forest tradition is that they're really only convinced by practice and what they can see people actually doing. If I tried to go to the forest monasteries and try to talk to them about the histories of ordination lineages and Dharmaguptakas and things like that, they'll go, oh yeah, whatever. That's just, yeah, so. But they see how people are living. Ah, okay, they'd be impressed by that. Yeah, and so this is what I think we need to do to foster the actual practice. Okay, so any more questions? Yeah, one here. Yeah? Yep. Yeah. Well, it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me, and I should hope it's good enough for most people. See, the thing is, it's really just a legal thing about the connection. So, yeah, it's true that the Buddha set up the rule and everything like that, but is there actually a connection of ordination? Because you need to have the bhikkhunis there to perform the bhikkhuni ordination, so the argument goes, yeah? So it's whether that connection is actually sustained is the problem. Yeah, either the bhikkhus alone can do it or can do it together with the bhikkhunis from the Chinese or tradition. Yeah.